This is Tech on the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Ben Johnson.
Yep, say what you will, but Star Trek has had a huge influence on techies, the gadgets they've designed, the world and the universe they have imagined. So we are marking the franchise's birthday all this week. Set your phasers to listen. Today, we're kicking things off with Mark Altman, known by some as the world's foremost Trekspert. He just released the second part of his Star Trek oral history, titled The 50-Year Mission, The Complete Uncensored Unauthorized Oral History of Star Trek. Mark, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, Ben, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So why oral history?
Well, I have to say, I am a huge fan of the oral history format. There was a book a couple of years ago. It was an oral history of MTV, which called I Want My MTV, which to me was just a fantastic way to tell that story. It had depth. It had humor. It really captured the voices of everyone involved. And it was like being at a really great dinner party with 500 different wacky people. And, you know, I feel that the history of Star Trek is very much like Rashomon. There's so many different perspectives. And that's why we had that quote from Robert Evans at the beginning. You know, there are three views of the truth, yours, mine, you know, and the truth, and no one is lying. And I feel the oral history format allows everyone to tell their side of the story without the author sort of being this objective voice of God, sort of landing on what's the truth. Because in a lot of cases, we don't really know what the truth is.
So if you had to describe Star Trek, the show, the franchise, to an alien species that knew nothing about it, how would you do that?
Well, didn't they make a movie about it? Was it Galaxy Quest that? Yeah, how would I describe? That's a good question. I would say it is a show that gives us a lens into the future in which mankind has grown technologically, but also, in the words of Dr. King, appeals to the better angels of our nature. And you could say it's wishful thinking or wish fulfillment. Hopefully it's prescient.
Aspirational, yeah. Hopefully it's
aspirational,
prescient.
Yes. Yeah. That's the short and more effective way of describing it than I just did.
Why has it gained such a cult following?
Well, I think it's part of what we just talked about, going to what you called aspirational. I think that, you know, particularly when you look at the 60s, which was a time of great turmoil, and then in the 70s where people had lost faith in the institutions of government with Watergate and things, to see a show which said there would be a future and it would be a better future and our technology wouldn't lead to an apocalyptic end and that we would explore the galaxy. It sort of goes back to that sort of the idea of us as a nation, not only nation builders, but as explorers, you know, colonizing the West, but in this case, colonizing the universe. And then once you get past sort of the utopian ethos, there's also the idea that the best Star Treks are about a family. And in the case of family, sometimes you argue, sometimes you disagree, sometimes you have spats, but ultimately you love each other. And that's a bond that cannot be broken. And certainly in the case of the original show and certainly the Next Generation, these were indeed very dynamic families.
It's interesting you talk about colonization of the universe, which in and of itself is kind of a tricky political topic, right? And since the beginning, it seems like the show has used sci-fi and technology as a buffer to discuss kind of tough topics happening in modern days. Can you talk about an episode that paralleled some of the issues in our world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes, you know, back to Gene Roddenberry, who was the creator of the show and the executive producer. He looked at Jonathan Swift and how Gulliver's Travels was able to comment about the issues of the time cloaked in fantasy and science fiction and allegory, and did the same thing with science fiction. It was a way when television was less adventurous and less willing to take a stand to talk about the issues of the day in a way that no one would be offended by doing it through the lens of science fiction. And great examples of that. The most infamous or famous example of this is Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, where there's these two warring cultures. One is black on one side, the other is white on the other side and black on the other. It's a very in-your-face, no pun intended, look at racial prejudice. But more effectively than that, there are episodes like A Taste of Armageddon in the first season where there's a war going on between two planets, but there's no destruction. People are asked to walk into disintegration chambers and die if they're deemed by a computer as a casualty. And the reason for that is it's a way that they can protect their culture and their civilization without having the damage and destruction caused by a real war. And, of course, Captain Kirk puts an end to this.
You realize what you have done?
Yes, I do. I've given you back the horrors of war. The Vendicans will now assume that you've broken your agreement and that you're preparing to wage real war with real weapons. They'll want to do the same. Only the next attack they launch will do a lot more than just count up numbers on a computer.
This is an allegory, in a way, for what was going on in Vietnam, where Walter Cronkite would come on TV and talk about the statistics of how many people died in Vietnam that day. And it was sort of, you know, to people back here in the States, sort of a bloodless kind of war, because they were just watching on their TV and they weren't really, you know, being affected on a day-to-day basis. It was, you know, in a way, to many, you know, war by computer. And, you know, it was a proxy fight. Even an awful episode like Spock's Brain, which was about Mr. Spock's brain being stolen by these sort of Nancy Sinatra clones in miniskirts.
Still sounds watchable somehow to me.
Incredibly
just
watchable.
Just so weird that it was, yeah, that's amazing.
But that was the time of the first heart transplant. So they were commenting on things that were very much in the zeitgeist at the time.
Was there any particular interview that you conducted for the book that just kind of blew your mind, somewhere that you didn't expect to be taken by one of the speakers who you're talking to for the oral history?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, I will tell you that, you know, in a way,
I know you're a Trexpert, so you know a lot of stuff, but I imagine somewhere someone surprised you, right?
I'll never live that down. The Los Angeles Times once labeled me the world's foremost Trexpert, and it follows you to the grave. But I will,
and maybe the next life, we'll see, you know.
That's right. I will say that, you know, the actors, we know their stories. They've all written books. They've told these stories ad nauseum at conventions. You know, you often wonder if these are actually true stories or just they've repeated the same story so many times that what they remember is the story they've told rather than what actually happened.
Sure.
But I think what was really fascinating was talking to a lot of the assistants, the secretaries, the people that you don't find, you know, as often in these kind of books. In one case, the assistant to a very important person in Star Trek history, Gene Kuhn, who was a producer on the original show, was Ande Richardson. Ande was someone who was really close with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And she worked for a guy named Gene Kuhn. And she was the first African-American assistant on the Desilu Paramount lot. And she had fascinating stories to tell about what it was like in that era. I mean, it was, in a way, you know, the real Mad Men.
There's a story in the book of Avery Brooks. This guy is an African-American. He played Captain Sisko on Deep Space Nine, and he got profiled by security on the set of the show. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Avery Brooks played the captain in Deep Space Nine, or actually in the beginning he played what, quote-unquote, the commander. It wasn't later until he was the captain, which was always an issue for him and a lot of the other producers. They felt that somehow it made him, it demeaned him. It made him less potent than the others because he wasn't a captain, and eventually he was promoted. But yeah, there is a story of a time in which, you know, it was his perception that he was being racially profiled on the Paramount lot. Because he was an African-American man. Here he was, the star of one of their biggest shows, and, you know, they wanted to check his trunk and see, make sure he wasn't stealing anything from the soundstage. You know, and it just goes to show, you know, the sort of the insidiousness of racial, you know, racial prejudice, and that even this man on the Paramount lot who was the star of a hit show was dealing that, you know, dealing with that on a, you know, on a daily basis. And it's really sad. And you like to think we've come, further in our culture in the last 20 years, but you know, I'm not sure we could really say that.
I'm going to admit that the book is very thick and I haven't read the whole thing yet. So I'm going
to
make
that
admission.
You should listen to the
audiobook. There you go. I just want to ask you, do you touch on the origin story of any technology that is well known in the show in the book, or any technology that was sort of used behind the scenes to make the show manifest in a way that was interesting? Did you hear any origin stories about
things
like that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I think that Star Trek endures is because Roddenberry was very savvy in, you know, not being lost in space, where it was just going to be this big, goofy, you know, flying saucer and, you know, alien space monsters and zap guns. He actually hired a cousin of his, Harvey Lynn, we talk about this in the book, who worked for the RAND company to sort of advise and consult. So a lot of the technology originally seen in Star Trek anticipates maybe not 300 years from now, but it anticipated 30 or 40 years from now, because we did see a diagnostic sick bay, medical technology, sliding doors, which you didn't even see at supermarkets at the time. You know, that was
sliding doors. That's really interesting.
You know, the computer, which was a response to voice command. I mean, it really presaged Siri and Alexa, where you had this enormous computer mind. And if you look at the memos, I mean, Gene Roddenberry is very specific about the fact that there would be a computer, a mainframe on board the Enterprise, which could answer questions about star bases or that part of the galaxy that they're exploring, or answer any questions about the you know, now we take that for granted. But if you look back then, computers were these giant behemoths that filled entire rooms. And he had this idea, you know, whether it be those disks, which we've now already surpassed, because, you know, they sort of had these colorful floppy disks, three-inch floppy disks. But the fact that the computer would respond to voice command. And then they had, you know, people talk about this in Next Generation, but you even saw it in the original series, the idea of the pad, the iPad, where they would do the crew evaluation reports and they would sign this device and it would have all this information on it, which is completely what an iPad or a tablet became. And, you know, as you move forward into Next Generation with the holodeck, there's the advent of virtual reality, which only now is sort of catching up with what you saw in Next Generation. So the science and technology was extremely important. I think the thing people talk about probably the most is the flip phone, because, of course, the communicator was really, you know, until that time, all people ever knew was sort of Dick Tracy with the watch.
Yeah.
But, you know, Star Trek introduced the idea of this device from a planet. You could communicate with the ship. You flipped it open. It made a cool sound. And that was a huge influence on the Motorola flip phone and cell phones and mobile phones. So while Star Trek, you know, now people look back and they say, oh, the show's dated, it looks so primitive. You know, I in a way find the whole notion offensive, because it's amazing in terms of what Star Trek anticipated. And so much of sci-fi in general in that genre looks goofy and ridiculous because the people never did their homework. And, you know, Roddenberry, to his credit, spent a lot of time talking and researching and learning about the future. Even then, he was researching lasers, and that's where he came up with the idea for the phaser, because they felt the laser was imminent, and then the Star Trek would seem behind the time. So they figured, okay, we'll call it a phaser, which will put us one step ahead. It's a, you know, really fascinating, and it's a great way to approach science fiction storytelling. And it was indeed, you know, very prescient. While we may never have transporters, you know, a huge amount of other things that Star Trek anticipated we either have or will ultimately have in the next, you know, 100 years.
Come on, don't say we're never going to have transporters. You're crushing my dreams when you say that.
But, you know, faster than light travel, who knows? subspace communications, you know, faster than light communications. I mean, all these things. I mean, but even a couple years ago, you saw that NASA was exploring the idea of a warp bubble, and, you know, warp ship, which, yeah, so, you know, there's really nothing that Star Trek depicted that is completely beyond the realm of possibility. You know, certainly nothing you look at and you say, oh, that's just ridiculous. That's impossible.
There's been a lot of advances in movie filming technology, computer graphics. Do you think something is getting lost in terms of some of the essence of Star Trek? For example, there's some reviews of the newest film that said it was too much like a regular blockbuster action film and less traditionally Star Trek-y.
Well, it's interesting because I do feel that, you know, that is a criticism the new films get, you know, that they're not allegories. Where's the more cerebral content? But that's always been the push and pull between the movie series and the TV series. If you look at even the earlier movies in the franchise with the original cast or the Next Generation cast, no one would look at them, with the exception probably of Wrath of Khan, as sort of the apex of the Star Trek universe. You know, you could make a case for Star Trek 1 being more heady and cerebral and certainly in a 2001 kind of way, or Star Trek 4 was ecologically savvy in which they had to save the whales, you know, because the future was endangered by the end of the species. In that sense, really the TV series had a lot more to say. And I think that there is also a truth to the fact that in the old days, Star Trek was purely a domestic phenomenon. It really was the movies only performed in the U.S. And, you know, now that, you know, because of the budgets, 200, 300 million, the movies need to work worldwide. So by necessity, there's more action. There's more adventure. There's more special effects. There are more things blowing up. And, you know, Star Trek isn't Star Wars. And so it's difficult to sort of find that middle ground where you're honoring 50 years of what the franchise is and at the same time sort of delivering on the thrills and the excitement that, you know, a modern day blockbuster sort of needs to work in the marketplace.
So what do you think is the biggest threat to the future of the Star Trek franchise?
Well, you know, that's a good question, Ben. I think we're seeing this. They always say that the Star Trek you love the most is the Star Trek you grew up with. So, you know, people who grew up in a certain era love the original. Other people who grew up love Next Generation. It goes on. Then there was this huge gap in which there was no Star Trek. And it seems that certainly millennials and definitely Generation Z don't have the same passion for Star Trek that many of us have. And I think part of that is because there is a certain cynicism that has permeated the culture. And Star Trek seems old-fashioned because of its optimism and its utopian ethos. And I think we need that. Everything's post-apocalyptic. And, you know, I enjoy Fury Road as much as the next person, but I think we need to see the antithesis of that as well. And that's what Star Trek represents, and that was what hopefully Star Trek will be again. It, you know, there's no war in the title. There's no Star Wars. It's Star Trek, which is an odyssey. It's a journey. It's traveling. That is inherently about exploration and about hope. And I think we need it back, but at the same time, it can't be cliche and it can't be goofy and it can't feel naive. It has to feel real. And, you know, that's what I think it'll take to keep people watching Star Trek for another 50 years.
Mark Altman, he is co-author of the Star Trek Oral History, The 50-Year Mission, The Next 25 Years from the Next Generation to J.J. Abrams. Mark, thanks a lot for coming by.
Oh, Ben, thanks for having me. I could talk about Star Trek all day and all night, but it was a pleasure talking to you about the Final Frontier.
Absolutely.